The Tom Woods Show, episode 452.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Want to learn a highly marketable skill in your spare time in a way that's rigorous and yet fun and engaging and inexpensive? Then learn web technologies at Code School. Get your free account through tomwoods.com/code. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Very interesting topic today. We're talking to George Kalantzis, who is director of the Wheaton Center for Early Christian Studies at Wheaton College. He's an associate professor in the Biblical and Theological Studies department there, and he has a book. It actually came out several years ago, but I only became familiar with it very recently, called Caesar and the Lamb: Early Christian Attitudes on War and Military Service. Now, he wrote this book from a purely scholarly standpoint, but to my mind, it has a lot of resonance, or ought to have a lot of resonance, for us today. This book says something pretty much exactly the opposite of what you would think would be the connection between Christianity and the military that you would get in neoconservative and a great many evangelical circles today. So it's a very challenging and very important book for us to grapple with. I'm linking to it on today's show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/452. Remember to check out my free ebook on how to start your new blog or website, even if you know nothing about programming or design, like me. You can find that book, plus find out how you can get me to give you free publicity for that blog you have not yet started. So check it out before you start that blog over at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, let's turn now to our guest today, Professor George Kalantzis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've just now been reading your book, Caesar and the Lamb, which I just introduced to the audience, and I have an interest in it for two reasons. I'm interested in it from a scholarly point of view, the way you are. But even though in your book you disclaim any concern about trying to connect your research in this book to current events, well, I have no such scruples. I do find it quite interesting that today, at least in the context of American politics, it's taken for granted that military service is very much a Christian vocation.
Right.
So I find it, I think it could be of some polemical use, even though I realize that as a scholar, you're not so keen on applying it that way yourselves. But just so you know, my audience, I think, will find it useful for that reason as well. What I thought was interesting, because I was not aware of it, is what you write in the introduction, and I want you to start there, mm-hmm. with the way scholars have debated this subject over the years. They can't deny that the early Christians clearly did not want to serve in the military,
right.
but they will deny the reasoning behind it, that it was some scholars will say it's not because of pacifism per se, it's just because of certain peculiarities of the Roman army. Tell us about some of these controversies and where your book rests in these controversies.
Yes, in scholarship, the debate is, or the discussion is there a difference between theory and practice? We have, even from the biblical narrative, the New Testament, we have Jesus exchanging or discussing with soldiers. We have Cornelius, who is a centurion, to whom Peter comes early on in the narrative of the book of Acts, and on and on. It is without debate that every Christian writer who wrote after the beginning of the 4th century opposed Christian participation in the military. And the reasons why they gave were three, perhaps four. The first one is the claim, the Christian claim, that Jesus is Lord, which is not just simply a pietist claim. Lord Kyrios, Dominus, is actually ontological for them. It means something. If Jesus is Lord, its counter is that Caesar cannot be. The second one, which we usually miss, is that the religiosity of the Roman army. The Roman army is a very religious institution. One enters it with a religious oath called the sacramentum. It sounds very much like the modern day sacrament, and it was. And throughout one's 20, 25 year career in the army, one serves under the auspices of the gods. Romans march into battle in having offered sacrifices before the battle, after the battle, and on and on. And when one comes to come out of the army, one still has to have a religious oath, a dissolving of the sacrament. So it's a religiosity that is imbued in the army. The third one is, of course, the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, not only in Exodus 20, but also repeated again by Jesus in Mark 10, when the rich man comes to Jesus and says, what should I do? The very first thing that Jesus says to him in order to have eternal life is, you shall not kill. And Christians took that very seriously. And the fourth one is one that we usually almost completely ignore, and that is the dominical command to love one's enemy. That's in Matthew 5:44. Jesus says, not only do you love your friends, but you are to love and pray for your enemies. And Christians took that very, very seriously. Now, were there Christians who served in the army? Clearly. But there's a difference between the theory of the Christians and the practice. And that's where the scholarly debate is. How does one see this? Does one begin with the practice of Christians? See, Christians are in the armies, and therefore we try to extrapolate what Christians believed, or do we begin with what Christians believed and try to explain why they acted differently than what they say they believed?
Let me fast forward ahead to, I don't know, maybe 20 to 25% through your book, where you pose a very stark question to other scholars, which is, in order to evaluate exactly what the Christian view was, let's see if we can find any examples at all of Christians being urged to serve in the military either as a Christian vocation or out of some sort of civic duty. And you give the absolutely point-blank answer that there is no such example whatever.
Right. And that is one of the things that I did in this book is I went and read through every piece of material we have, Greek, Latin, Syriac, everything, for the first 3.5 centuries. There is not a single Christian writer, not one, who advocates for military service as a pious Christian vocation. Not one. And that was kind of startling to me. There's not a place for a debate on this. The material is just completely missing.
All right. Now, I want to try to understand exactly what the reasons are for Christian objection to participation in the military. As you say, there's more than one, but let's begin with one that every scholar agrees on, which is the religious character of the army. What exactly would Christians be expected to do that would violate their consciences?
Pretty much everything. The Roman religious system is permeating during this time and all the way through. It's permeating every aspect of life. For example, as I said before, a soldier would enter the military ranks by offering an oath to the gods, a sacrament, and with that, one would offer a sacrifice. It can be incense, it can be other things. These are sacrifices to pagan gods, to pagan deities, and they swear an oath to the genius of Caesar or to the well-being of Caesar, an oath of loyalty to Caesar in the presence of the gods, which clearly Christians cannot do. Secondly, repeatedly throughout the year, the regiment or the legions or the armies would have to come information in the camp and offer sacrifices to the gods is a Roman way of pledging allegiance to both Caesar and to the country, Rome, the empire in this case, but also to the gods. And they always bring the gods as witnesses to that. Again, Christians cannot do that. Why? Because for Christians, Jesus is Lord. And if Jesus is Lord, Caesar cannot be at the same time co-Lord or supreme Lord over God. So sacrifices to enter, sacrifices throughout the year. The marching into battle, when that happened, it wasn't as frequent as we want it to be or as movies make it to be, but there were occasions for that. The armies, the cohorts, the legions would stand in formation and offer sacrifices, actual sacrifices to the gods, so that the gods may protect them. Prayers are offered, and all of these go against what it means to be a Christian, because a Christian recognizes, back then and still now, that there is one principal authority, one Lord, and that is God, that is Christ, and therefore it is to him that we pledge allegiance. So Christian writers of this time, up to the 4th century, the transformation of the empire in the 4th century, see the military oath or any other sense of allegiance. They extend that quite a bit into the civic administration also, as a counter-baptismal oath, as an oath counter one's Christian baptism. And that's the primary one to which they object.
I think a lot of people are unaware of just how pervasive religious ritual was both in ancient Rome and in ancient Greece, in part because I think the Enlightenment wanted to portray classical civilizations as being like a mini 18th century salon.
Right.
You know, where they didn't have Christianity, so therefore they were probably entirely secular, or their religious ritual and commitment doesn't really need to be taken account of. But it was absolutely pervasive throughout both societies. What about the religious character of the figure of the emperor himself?
That's a wonderful question. In the 4th century, especially in the 4th century BC and AD, in that transition year of the early empire, after the death of Julius Caesar, we have to remember back in our history that Julius Caesar is elevated, declared by the Senate to be a god. Well, his adopted son Octavius, who became known as Augustus, is now the son of a god, right? And that is a title that continues in the next five generations to come to the end of the first century to be transformed into a living god. So the very figure of Caesar himself is one in which Romans saw a deified person. Now, ancient people are not idiots. They're just, you know, in ancient times, they don't expect the Caesars to make the rain come or the crops to flourish. What they understand is that relationship in which these beings, Caesar in this case, is closer to the gods than we common people are. The second element is that Caesar in one's own person is also the chief priest, the chief religious authority, even though he didn't exercise often the right of the Pontifex Maximus. He was in himself the chief religious authority of the empire. So in the very person of Caesar, we have a culmination of both piety, religiosity, civic structure, the one who connects with the gods, the one who, at least in theory, is able to interpret the will of the gods, a very forceful and powerful personality.
All right. Now, having established what is, I think, indisputable, let's go to the part of your thesis that would be more debated, even though, as you say, you've gone through the sources, you've discuss them in detail in this book. It's chapter after chapter devoted to one or two or three figures. Let's look at the very earliest sources that you talk about here after the New Testament. The earliest sources that I can think of are the ones you've got in here. You've got the Didache, you've got the first letter of Clement, which is written toward the end of the first century. We've got Ignatius of Antioch, we're moving into the early second century, and then also in the second century, Justin Martyr. I've read a lot of this stuff, but it's been quite a long time, and I don't recall what the relevance of these documents is. In First Clement, I know that I remember the analogy he draws between the Roman army and the church, ideally, the discipline that ought to be in both, and that they should all be of one single mind the way the Roman army is. But maybe you can help us understand how these relate to the question.
The argument has been made quite often that, for example, I'll pull it a little bit back earlier into Paul, when Paul talks about Christians are to put on the armor of God, and then he goes on to describe what that armor looks like, that when he uses military language, that, see, Paul allows for military language, imagery, and therefore service. The same thing with Clement. Clement says, you know, be like soldiers, be faithful in 1 Clement 37, and, you know, express the eagerness as soldiers under the blameless command. And the argument is that because he uses such language, these sources use such language, they therefore condone military service. What I'm showing here by putting them in context is that actually, no, they just use the analogy of military, the analogy of a soldier. But what they're actually saying is that Christians should be without deviation, strong and eager as a military unit. It does not condone, the language does not condone military service. It just uses the analogy.
Right. But what else do we, I mean, when I think back to, like, what does Justin Martyr have to say about all this? I mean, my recollection of Justin Martyr is his interest in reconciling the classical philosophers with the Christian revelation.
What we see in these transition period of the second century, in Clement, in Justin, in the martyrdom of Polycarp, is something that is absolutely unbelievable to the Romans, and with them to the world around them. And that is Christians not only do not fight, etc., but they're not afraid to die. And that is something that is unique in this. They're not afraid to die in witness to Christ, to being Christians. And what Justin talks about that in his dialogue with Trypho is, look, these Christians are willing to be martyred, to bear witness, and therefore to die. In his apology, in his first apology, Justin does exactly that, that Christianity is an active transformation from a society that understands the world here as the dominant structure to a world that is of God, that only happens to be here for a period of time. And he keeps on talking about how Christians conquer enmity, those who are their enemies, by their love, by their good works, by not being rebels. And that is another characteristic of Christianity that writers, Christian writers, bring up, that Christians do not rebel. They honor Caesar. They honor the secular authorities, not by obeying them in doing what they're not supposed to do or they cannot do, but by placing them in their proper place. So Justin, in that transformational period of the second century, moves from a classical understanding of what it means to be a citizen to what it means now to be a Christian citizen of a different kingdom with a different king.
Let's pause for just a moment for this message. Folks, it's a tough economy out there, but at the same time, there's never been an easier time to acquire marketable skills. You've got the internet. And case in point is a place called Code School, which you can visit through tomwoods.com/code. I'm intrigued by it. I've actually checked it out myself. You can become a web developer. You can become a better web developer than you already are. You can design apps. You can be involved in web design. The sky's the limit. And you can learn it cheaply, at your convenience, and in a way that's actually enjoyable. As a matter of fact, a listener of this show wrote into me and said, I think it's awesome you're promoting self-taught web development stuff on your show. That's the field I'm in, and it's amazing to me how scarce the talent is. I've seen motivated friends of mine change career paths, self-teach, and land great jobs within 6 months' time. Definitely a great career. Get your free account through tomwoods.com/code. I'm interested in what you have to say about Tertullian and Origen, both of whom, of course, were widely read, continue to be widely read, each of whom had his brushes with heterodoxy, let's say, but who, of course, Origen was quite eager to be martyred, it seems, if I recall his story correctly. So I'm sure he fits into this somehow. But because they wrote so copiously, I'd like you to tell us something about what they had to say.
Tertullian and Origen are wonderful examples of this because, as you said, they wrote so much. Tertullian is a convert to Christianity. He's a Latin speaker, lawyer in Carthage. Origen is a Greek speaker in Alexandria. He's born to a Christian family. So the two come from different backgrounds. One comes from a pagan background, the other comes from a Christian background. Tertullian writes repeatedly, and he's in a place in Carthage, in an environment in which Christianity is growing, but it's still a very, very small minority. But Tertullian is willing to say what needs to be said. He talks about bearing witness as the proper stance for Christians. For example, there are Christians in the camps close to where he lives, and they march in formation. And one of them does not wear the wreath that the we can consider in our times. He refuses to have the medal pinned on him because, you know, the honor of the unit. And he holds it in his hand as a sign that he refuses to accept it. And the rest of the Christians in the unit say to him, "Why are you doing this? You're going to bring trouble on us." And Tertullian recounts him, and he, Tertullian, then takes the side that, you know what? As Christians, we have to stand for who we are and what we believe, regardless of the consequence. So Tertullian is going to talk about the Christians as the soldiers of Christ, as he calls them. He's the one who is going to insist that Christians do not rebel. Unlike other people, when they reject the authority of Caesar, they do not rebel. And the example that we can think about here is the example of, let's say, Peter or Paul, the apostles, right? Well, on the one hand, they honor Caesar. On the other, they refuse to do what Caesar says. How do they honor Caesar? By placing Caesar, and by that I mean the secular authority, in its proper place and refusing to obey the command. So how is that honoring Caesar? Because it doesn't rebel. And what's the consequence? The consequence is that they allow Caesar to kill them. And that is a pivotal point in all this discussion. That honor of Caesar, again, by that we mean the state, does not mean obedience to the state. It means that we recognize the authority of the state to affect the consequence of disobedience. We honor them by not rebelling. Origen is the son of a martyr. His father was taken and executed when he was a late teenager, around 17, when Origen was around 17. And he spent the rest of his life in that parenthesis between his father being martyred, him being an advocate to those who were martyred in the theaters of his time, and at the end, he himself suffering in persecution. What Origen does is he shows even more profoundly what it means actually to be a Christian. And what he does is he takes head on the classical pagan objection to Christians refusing to serve in the military, Celsus, a pagan writer who writes about two generations before Origen, takes Christians to task. Celsus is the first pagan, the first non-Christian to take Christianity seriously. And he says, okay, explain to me this, he says. If I accept your, can I call it pacifist or peacemaking stance of not serving, why do you accept the profits and the benefits that Caesar and his armies give you, the state gives you, and refuse to serve with him? And Origen says, you have it backwards. You don't recognize that it is God who gives, and the prayers of the Christians are the ones who protect the state, not the legions of Caesar. And he continues, in an exasperated state, the question comes, what would happen if everyone in the state did as you Christians do and refused to participate? And Origen has a beautiful line where he says, if everyone followed the way of the Christians, we wouldn't have enemies.
Well, that's a pretty good
answer. It's pretty straightforward, right? So yeah. What do you do with the barbarians? You transfer them, you transform into Christians, and you don't have enemies. And there you are. But these are people who, what we have to realize is that these are people who are willing to die for this. And they did. Origen was martyred, and many of them did. They were killed for their faith because they refused to take up arms.
Now, where do we see it most clearly stated? You as a Christian, cannot participate in the military? Do we ever see it spelled out in black and white in that way, directed to the Christian community?
In Scripture or in the writings of the
In these early writings of the fathers.
We see it throughout, and in actually many of them, Tertullian on idolatry, on the crown, writes on it. But primarily it comes, or even more fully, comes in the collection of documents called church order documents. These are documents that go through a variety of editions from the middle of the second century all the way to the fourth century. These are church canons, if you wish. These are documents that the churches have. When somebody comes and says, I want to be baptized, they go, okay, let's go through catechesis. What is this Christian faith? What is the Christian practice? And these are documents that catalog what kinds of professions Christians cannot have or what kind of behavior is expected of Christians. And they have whole catalogs of these. For example, Christians cannot be, they say, brothel keepers, right? You cannot be a Christian and be a brothel keeper. You cannot be a Christian and be a gladiator. Well, there are other categories of that that have to do with paganism, they have to do with killing, and a whole list of them repeatedly say a Christian cannot be in the army. And they separate two categories. They separate, especially towards the latter part of the third century and beginning of the fourth century, the categories of those who convert to Christianity while in the military, and to them, this church order document say, if you want to come to be baptized and you have already been in the military, you are in the military, then you have to refuse, you have to refuse the order to kill. You have to refuse it. If you're not willing to refuse the order to kill, you cannot be baptized in the church. And the second category is the category of those who want to be baptized into the Christian church, and that's the sign by which, or the means by which, people became Christians, and then go and serve in the military. And the church order documents have apostolic constitution, etc., have very harsh words for these people. They say, send those people away because they do two things. First, they make a mockery of God. And secondly, they lie to the state. And you go, wait. How can they make a mockery of God and lie to the state? Well, they lie to the state because they say that I want to be under your orders, but I will not do what you tell me to do. Otherwise, I cannot be a good Christian. And they lie to God. They make mockery of God because they say, I can say on the one hand, or I can profess in baptism that Jesus is Lord. And on the other, I can cross the street and go and say, Caesar is Lord. That cannot happen. So the church order documents are the most present and clear statement of that.
Now, this just to wrap up, there are two things that changed in the centuries that follow the period that you're covering, and one of them goes beyond a bit the scope of our discussion. But certainly, one thing that changes is you begin to see Christian discussions of why it can be legitimate to rebel. Like, you certainly get that certainly in the second millennium, you get quite a few people arguing that. But then, secondly, apparently at some point, you get some kind of validation of military service as being worthy of the Christian. Can you tell us how that happens?
There is a transition period, very rapid transition period, so much so that people of that time thought that the second coming of Christ had already happened, which is the reign of Constantine the Great in the beginning of the fourth century. It is a transition time between the end of the third century, in which Christians, a minority, growing minority, but still a minority, are persecuted, actively persecuted. The great persecution of the church, the so-called great persecution of the church in the beginning of the fourth century, ends not only with the legalization of Christianity. Now, after 313, Christianity is a legal versus an illegal religion, but also slowly in that fourth century, we move from roughly the 320s to the 380s. In that period of 60 years, a transition from a pagan empire to a Christian empire. In the year 380, Theodosius I is going to be an emperor who is not only Christian, but now he's going to make Christianity the only religion of the empire. So in a period of two generations, we have moved from a completely pagan empire. And now we have to think from Britain to Persia, right? That whole region has been transformed legally into a Christian environment. Now, the question is not, well, the state, the pagan state, has legions. Can Christian participate in that? The question is transformed now to, the state is Christian. What do we do with the legions that are now fighting under the Christian labrum, the Christian cross? And in the year 416, Theodosius II, unfortunately they have the same name, first and second, bans pagans from the military. 120 years, 130 years earlier, Diocletian, another previous emperor, had banned Christians from the military. Now in 416, pagans are banned from the military. And the military is transformed completely into Christians. Everyone has been baptized in the empire, almost everyone has been baptized, and therefore it is the beginning in this fourth century of what we call Christendom. Christendom, then, as the reign of Christ on earth within structures of state, is what is the Roman Empire into the Byzantine Empire, into the Holy Roman Empire, and from there moves into the High Middle Ages, and on and on and on. So what happens is this transformation, not only of military or non-military, it doesn't really matter, but the transformation of the state itself from an entity that to which Christians are adjunct at the periphery and at the margins to an entity in which Christianity and Christians are the center of power. And once Christianity moves from the margins to the center of power, now it owns the problems of being at the center of power. Up to the third century, up to the fourth century, Christians could point and say, you, state, whatever emperor, it doesn't really matter, you, state, are under the authority of God, and we, Christians, are going to hold you accountable to being properly under the authority of God, but we're going to be at the margins of this discussion. You, at the center, can dictate. Now, within three generations, the roles have shifted. Now, Christianity, the church, Christianity, Christians, not only own the seat of power, they own the roads, they own the borders, they own the tax system, they own, well, the legions. So the question is transformed now. And what used to be the religiosity of the Roman army owing itself to the protection of the pagan gods now has been transformed in the late fourth century to the protection of the Christian God. The practice did not change. What changed is the focus. So when in the third century, soldiers as a legion or as a cohort would stand and offer a sacrifice to the pagan gods for protection, now, three generations later, the same cohort would stand in the same field and offer prayers for protection. And for many of us, this is a place in a period, the fourth century and the beginning of the fifth century, in which the whole thing, the whole paradigm changes. That then moves into the discussions of late antiquity, from late antiquity into medieval ages, into pre-Reformation, pre-Enlightenment, and post-Enlightenment periods. So we're looking back all the way back to the pre-Christendom years to see what Christians and Christianity was before it was at the center of power.
All right, I'm sorry I keep saying I'm going to let you go, but I just have to follow up on that because it seems to create, well, it creates a problem in my mind because I understand what you're saying, that now the Christian, first of all, the aspects of Roman society and Roman military that were offensive to Christians are now absent. Secondly, there is the practical question of, well, we're in charge now, so somebody's got to keep an eye on the frontiers.
Right.
But that sort of pragmatic concern, I guess, only comes up when you're in charge, so I see that wouldn't have come up before. But they still have to deal with what, in your book, is the central moral problem of serving in the military, which is bloodshed. There's going to be bloodshed, whether it's a Christian empire, whether it's Christendom, whether it's classical antiquity, whatever, there's still going to be that major moral problem. How do they just glide over that?
And that's an absolutely wonderful question. And that is an amazing transformation that happens in the fourth century. It almost happens within a generation. Now, there are, throughout this period, people who hold the sixth commandment and the command to love the enemy and elevate them and say, no, this is what it means to be a Christian. We cannot do it. So the voices of peacemaking do not go away. But the pragmatics overshadow everything. Even in the late 4th century, Basil of Caesarea, one of the bishops of Caesarea, one of the great bishops of Christianity and theologians, says, one who has been in the military, who has been in the army, cannot come to the Eucharist for 3 years. It's not about punishment. It's about pastoral care of those who have been in the armies, those who have been in battle. It's not that they glide over it. It is that the pragmatics suddenly take over. I use a very, very bad analogy. Most analogies are bad. This one is particularly bad, but I'm going to use it. It is like the dog that is chasing a car, right? And you go after it, and suddenly the car slows down, and you grab the tire. Now what do you do with it? You actually don't know how to drive this. You don't belong in the car. What do you do with this? And what happens is Christianity is an identity crisis in the fourth century. The historians like Lactantius or Eusebius wrote both before the advent of Constantine and during his reign. You can see them pivot almost immediately into a millennial exuberance that Christ has come in the face of Constantine, in the name of Constantine, and we're in charge. Okay, now what? And they go silent.
That's a very, very interesting transition.
Yes.
And that I had not thought of and hadn't really known about or realized or understood until you just talked about it right here. So this is very, very interesting material. I don't need to persuade you of that. The book we've been talking about is Caesar and the Lamb, Early Christian Attitudes on War and Military Service. I will be linking to it on today's show notes page for episode 452, tomwoods.com/452. I'll link to your professional page over at Wheaton so people can find out more about you. And thanks so much for your time today. Very, very interesting.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right, everybody. Caesar and the Lamb is a good book to accompany the new Ron Paul book, of course, on war, which you can find at tomwoods.com/swords. Because the book is Swords into Plowshares. That'll take you right to the Amazon page. Check those out. Also, we are having fun over in the brand new private Facebook group for the supporting listeners. The Facebook group is accessible through tomwoods.com/Facebook group. And it's just a great bunch of folks, and we're having great conversations already. It's exclusive. It's just for supporting listeners, so you got to head over to supportinglisteners.com and jump on board. And I am in this group interacting with people far more than I should be. I knew this was going to happen. I'm talking way too much, but we're having a great time. So I hope you can join us over there and join me tomorrow for another episode of the show. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.